This is Emily with your Politics in Action report at your local radio station, CJMQ 88.9 FM, bringing you your local, provincial, and federal political news. Taking the news to Granby, Quebec, despite opposition to the wage hike, Granby elected officials saw their wages increase anywhere between 15 and 17%. Mayor Pascal Bonin saw his wage heighten from approximately $104,000 to $119,000. As such, elected officials will see their wages increase from $34,000 to $40,000. Citizens have mixed reactions to said wage hike. Some have argued with a great salary comes a greater incentive to perform well in a job. Others in opposition argued for a job that is not full-time, they receive a decent amount already to begin with. As I stated with my previous story when citizens were petitioning against this, it does not make sense to augment the salaries of the elected officials who are supposed to be representative of the people. According to the mission of Granby's mayor, Pascal Bonin, Granby is a radiant community, and to continue set radiance involves listening to the voices of Granby citizens. As well, Bonin holds public consultations every month on Saturdays for citizens of Granby to express their concerns, problems, and visions. Therefore, if Granby citizens were in apparent opposition to the proposed wage hike, the mayor should have kept this in mind in voting for the proposed wage change. To understand why Granby citizens are in great opposition to this wage hike, it is relevant to understand the population. Granby is a working-class city that was founded on factory construction. Granby has a population of approximately 66,000, according to the 2016 census. The average total income among Granbians was 37,756. Among the Canadian census, it is evident that the majority of citizens in Granby have a salary less than 50,000 annually. Putting these numbers into perspective, you know that the majority of the population earns less than the top minority. With that, we can expect that the majority of Granbians elected their mayor on the premise he would represent their interests, whether that is in the form of improving infrastructure in Granby or investments into tourism. So increasing the wages of the minority of Granbians who not only have authority in their elected positions, but work only part-time, increasing their wages, sends the wrong message to the people they are supposed to represent. An alcoholic beverage thought to be linked to a Laval teen's death has been removed from the shelves of Couche-Tards across Quebec. The brand is called F'd Up and was related to the death of 14-year-old Lafina Gervais, who was said to have consumed the drink prior to her disappearance. With much media coverage of this event, what we see here with the case of Athena Gervais is association with moral panic. As the case had been covered extensively, the public immediately demanded answers to her death. Once it was discovered Gervais had consumed a brand of alcohol from the local Couche-Tard, there was the incidence of a moral panic as Couche-Tards were hasty to remove the product from its shelves. Often, a moral panic incident is endorsed by extensive media coverage, which is the case with Athena Gervais. In other words, it is like a heist to figure out what or who was responsible for the death of a person. The fact that any teen can purchase or have access to this product at dépanneurs, this generates paranoia and insecurity in terms of the fact that this could happen to any teen, to anyone's child, grandchild, niece, or nephew. As such, Gelasso Group, the company that produces the alcoholic beverage, stated it has since ceased to produce the particular beverage associated with the death of Gervais. The company is looking into greater restrictions to be applied to this product. The company also stated the sale of this product was a mistake, as initially proposed to compete with U.S. competitor Four Loko. The marketing for the product was targeted to youth age 18 to 25. As such, the coloring of the bottles are a magnet, and when teens visit the Couche-Tard, that would have been one of the products they see first and take interest in. Couche-Tard has stated that removing the product from the shelves was more of an act of responsibility rather than legality, as the product was legal to sell. Politicians, as well as not-for-profit organization Éduc'alcool, have appealed to Health Canada for further regulation of alcoholic energy drinks. Health Canada has since responded to the request, stating it is the responsibility of the provinces in considering affairs of marketing products and point-of-sale restrictions. What this case tells us is that often it becomes too late to act on an issue, such as youth accessibility to alcohol. It always takes a tragedy to occur before authorities could ever prevent it from happening in the first place. Since 7 members have left the Bloc Québécois, Maxine Ouellette has responded to this departure. Ouellette expressed her doubts that members left the party not because of leadership issues, but rather because there was a misunderstanding of the Bloc's role in federal politics. Ouellette argued that Quebec's interests represented at the federal level are not independent from the prospects of Quebec's sovereignty. As such, the Bloc leader points out that Article 1 of the party's platform upholds sovereignty, and it is the duty of party members to promote sovereignty in all forums. As I previously stated, discussions of sovereignty are generally less favorable by the public. A poll conducted by Statistica indicates that 64% of Quebec citizens believe Quebec will remain in Canada. As well, a poll conducted by Angus Reid Institute found 82% of participants believe, quote-unquote, ultimately Quebec should remain in Canada, end quote. Part of this is attributed to the fact that the general populace believe that Quebec already has enough sovereignty under the Canadian Union. This is why even provincial parties tend to downplay the talks of sovereignty, and they will talk about matters such as affordable housing and healthcare, which is generally more appealing to voters. Even less favorable is promoting sovereignty at the federal level. Even though the purpose of the Bloc is to appeal to French Canadiens at the federal level, it is difficult to compete with other parties because citizens will feel that the alternative parties have more to offer and are not solely focused on one issue, one demographic. The members who have left the party stipulate the necessity to represent Quebecers at the federal level without constantly focusing on sovereignty. In response, Ouellette is proposing to hold a referendum to clarify the mission of the Bloc, which is said to be held in mid-April. Holding a referendum to discern the party's outlook demonstrates Ouellette isn't fully confident in her leadership and needs assurance from other party members. Holding this referendum as such also shows her denial of her leadership skills being put into question. With the way things are going now, it is predicted that the Bloc will only accumulate approximately 12% of the popular vote. So things will need to change if the party is to be successful in the next election, and with Ouellette as leader, the party will not go far. This goes without saying, if the party lacks stability on the inside, there is no chance for its survival in the realm of federal politics. Taking the news to our provincial neighbor, the race for the Ontario PC Party ended with a long wait to hear the results. The delay was reported to have been due to the recount, and that was incentivized by the close proximity of the votes. Ford had won by approximately 150 votes to the runner-up Christine Elliott, followed by Carolyn Mulrooney securing third place, and Tanya Granick-Allen in fourth. This was reported to have been the shortest election campaign in Ontario PC party history, dating back to mid to late January to March 10th, when the announcement of the party's leader was scheduled. It has been a rough and rocky road the Ontario PCs have traveled. Initially, the party had secured its leader back in 2015 with Patrick Brown. Due to sexual assault allegations, Brown resigned reluctantly and has since backed out of the leadership race. Among the party candidates, Carolyn Mulrooney and Doug Ford have one thing in common. Their families have history in politics. Mulrooney, as you may be aware, is the daughter of former Prime Minister Brian Mulrooney. Like daughter, like father, Mulrooney expressed desires to enter into politics just like her father. As well, we have Doug Ford, who is the brother of the late Rob Ford, former mayor of Toronto. It is interesting the Conservatives have picked Doug Ford, but not all that surprising. It is interesting because the Ford family has a bit of a reputation relative to the fallout of Mayor Rob Ford during the drinking and drug scandal and still being able to have confidence in his brother to lead the party. Then there is the philosophy, don't blame the sibling for the sins of the brother. Therefore, Doug will be different and more professional than his brother. Ford campaigned on promises to get rid of government waste, eliminate corruption, and provide a voice for the grassroots of the party. He claims his experience as a businessman makes for an asset. By the manner Ford speaks and the fact that he is a businessman, some have made comparisons with Ford as the Ontario equivalent to Donald Trump. It's not surprising the PC would pick a man to lead the Ontario PCs given its history. Looking at the four candidates, three female and one male, there was no mistake in the male would be selected. The Ontario PCs have never had a female leader, which would mean breaking the gender barrier and allowing the first woman in history to become the PC leader. And I am not quite sure the Ontario PCs are ready for that. The question we must ask is whether Doug Ford will be enough to defeat Kathleen Wynne in the 2018 provincial election. Was he the right choice? It will take the next few months of campaigning to see whether Ford is appealing to voters, and the next few months to determine whether or not he was successful. Students often tussle the disadvantage of accumulating debt with achieving the necessary skills to succeed in the labor force. With that, the federal government is attempting to overcome the problems of bad debts by attempting to understand why graduates from private career colleges have a greater likelihood of having difficulties repaying their student loans. This comes with approximately 9% of 500,000 students who receive federal assistance annually through Canadian student loans are designated to private schools. As such, research has demonstrated that career college students have a greater likelihood of defaulting on their student loans and have difficulty making the payments on time. Statistics demonstrate that private college graduates are 3 times more likely than university graduates to default their student loans, even though college graduates hold on average less than $5,000 less in their debt. The incentive is to enable to collect this money for federal purposes without writing it off. Some explanations for this include the fact that career college students are typically older and have greater responsibilities, such as children, and may face potential barriers to employment. Typically, those who may not have had the opportunity to go to school earlier will opt for career colleges because they believe it is faster and perhaps easier than studying through a 4-year course-loaded university program. Also, people don't have time for a university degree and feel they are not getting any younger, therefore, career college seems like a cost-effective choice. As such, the federal government is attempting to find solutions to tackle this problem by enacting diverse payment options. In the first presentation of the federal budget by the Trudeau government, they increased the minimum earnings to $25,000 a year to when graduates are required to repay their student loans. This gives students who had recently entered the job market sufficient time to find a job, secure a job, and have a stable flow of income. Once recent graduates are financially stable, only then could they tackle the weight of their student debt. The Canadian Federation of Students have advocated for the Liberal government to eliminate interest rates from student loans, as they had done with the loan permitted to Bombardier. There is some truth to that in saying that if you're going to give an exception to interest-free loans for a corporation like Bombardier, they should have no problem doing this for students who are at more risk of defaulting and have greater difficulty with handling their expenses when compared to a corporate giant like Bombardier. As well, careers associated with private colleges tend to yield lower returns in terms of the education level when compared to people who hold a university degree. When compared to people with solely a high school leaving, individuals with a college degree earn approximately 22% more than high school candidates, while university degree holders earn 37% higher in comparison. This study was conducted by Martin Prosperity Institute and the Institute for Competitiveness and Prosperity. What these studies do suggest is that people who hold a university degree earn higher wages and therefore can manage their student debt load far easier than college diploma holders. It is no question that education is not so easily affordable, especially with long-term debts. By relieving the challenges associated with paying off student debts, the federal government can then hope for greater contribution to the economy by people who are less financially burdened. For the first time in Canadian history, a Canadian cabinet minister, has given birth while serving office. Karina Gold is Minister of Democratic Institutions and is the representative for Burlington, Ontario. Gold is, as well, the first federal minister to take maternity leave. Nova Scotia MP Scott Bryson is temporarily substituting in Gold's place. While Gold is the first cabinet minister to have given birth while holding office, she was not the first MP to do so. In 1987, the Liberal MP Sheila Copps was the first MP to give birth while sitting in the House of Commons. Copps was a renowned female politician, being the first female to have ever held a position of Deputy Prime Minister, and has served 10 years in Jean Chrétien's federal cabinet in the 1990s. As time progresses, we can't help but take notice this wave of women's empowerment. Women are breaking away from the traditional roles of being a stay-at-home parent. Women are moving above and beyond these expectations by juggling both motherhood and a successful career. However, that being said, when it comes time for settling down and starting a family, MPs who are mothers want to be there within the first few months of their child's life. Simply because MPs are representatives of Canadian people shouldn't mean they are not entitled to the same rights as other Canadians, and that is the right to have paid parental leave. What we have heard here is the case of the mother load, the struggle for women to have a career, all the while juggling being a mother. Oftentimes, there is a great amount of pressure for women to be great mothers, and oftentimes, the heavy workload they receive from their jobs forces them to make a choice. The majority of the time, women will choose to stay at home for many reasons, such as being there for their children, as children are their top priority. MPs don't really get that option. What we are seeing more of is politicians proving they can have it all, a family and a successful career. This is greatly supported by the Liberal government's initiative to promote gender equality. It is with reason female politicians are more empowered to start families and have a career. This is evident with Karina Gold and NDP MP for Churchill, Manitoba, Nikki Ashton, who gave birth to twins in November and resumed her post in the House of Commons in January. Female politicians have been in the media over the past years. You may recall the headlines made when an Australian politician was breastfeeding in Parliament, all the while passing a motion in Senate. Because MPs do not pay into employment insurance, they are not permitted to take any parental leave, making it difficult for female MPs who give birth while holding time in office. The Liberal government has expressed desires to change this so as to grant female politicians paid parental leave. That is it for this session of Politics in Action. Until then, take care. I'm Emily at CJMQ 88.9 FM.